From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in a suburban town in California. A man named David Vahil had come home to his parents one summer, and they were sitting in the backyard. Just over the fence, his neighbors had trees brimming with oranges, figs, and loquats. And he wondered in that moment, what would it take to remove the fences and offer that food to the wider community? After all, no single family could consume that many figs or that many oranges. Wasn't there a better way? Well, David Vahil is now project manager for East New York Farms in Brooklyn. And this hour, we're talking about urban agriculture. Have you ever driven past an empty lot in Rochester, for example, or Geneva, or really anywhere? David Vahil would instantly envision crops growing all across it. Do you? This is a conversation about more than food. It's about food systems and access. It's about opportunity and jobs. It's about how we design and shape our cities. And the Reshaping Rochester series is focusing its next event on the benefits of urban agriculture. What are the lessons from Brooklyn that might apply here? It's our chance to discuss it this hour with my guests. And first, let me welcome two guys who are on the line with us. David's one of them. David Vahil's project manager, director for East New York Farms in Brooklyn. David, welcome to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And Jonatul Rahman is markets and outreach coordinator for East New York Farms in Brooklyn. And Jonatul is on the line as well. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
And let me now also welcome who is in studio with us. Maria Fergiuelli is here, interim executive director of the Community Design Center of Rochester. Maria, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Evan.
Also here is Lisa Zeller. She's an 8th grade science teacher and garden club advisor at World of Inquiry School number 58. Lisa, welcome to you.
Thank you, Evan.
And Nathaniel Mish is here, community programs coordinator for FoodLink and manager of the Lexington Avenue Urban Farm. Nathaniel, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
Do you also envision crops growing all across empty lots when you see them?
Yes, in every front yard, too.
Well, Maria, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's coming up next Tuesday? Next Tuesday is the next event in the Reshaping Rochester series. The title of this one, Growing Food, Jobs, and Engagement, The Benefits of Urban Agriculture. What's coming up, and how did you get hooked up with these guys?
Well, we're so very happy to have David Vahil come visit us. And we have a committee of folks that are involved with the Community Design Center, board members and other people that we brainstorm and try to think of things that we'd like to see here in Rochester. And then we reach out to people that seem to be doing it well in other places. And so one of our committee members, I think it was a board member, that had some information about David and brought it to our attention. We were very, very fortunate that he was able to join us.
Well, David, I mentioned that story that I heard you tell in one of the many videos that I've seen of you and online and kind of talking about the work that you've done. Can you take me back to growing up? You said you had, what, plum, apricot, Meyer lemon trees, among many other things. There was always sort of fruit around you?
Yeah, I think that's one of the luxuries of growing up in California, where a lot of that stuff grows really easily. And growing up in an area, too, that used to be farmland, and I think it really just sort of, it's a matter of changing your viewpoint. It's, you know, you can look across and you can see houses and backyards, and or you can look across and you can see, oh, that this used to be an orchard 50 years ago, or, you know, in the case of some place like New York City, it might have been 100 or 200 years ago that it was farmland. But we're really never far from those origins, wherever we are.
And did you say that it was you went off to do schoolwork and started thinking about better systems, didn't you?
Exactly. Yeah, I went to school on a small farm and ranch in California and then finished my undergraduate degree in New York City. And I think it was sort of those two combined experiences, going to school on a farm and then going to school in the middle of the city, that I started to think about, you know, what kind of programs I could join or organizations that were really doing that work to bridge that gap between, you know, food production and urban areas.
And David, when you were kind of visiting your parents in the story that I told to open the hour, and you're looking at trees across the fences and thinking about, you know, how much does a family need? How do we do it better? Is it hard for you doing the work that you do to not think about food waste?
You know, I think on the scale of what we grow here, I think it's very efficient. So,
yeah.
I think food waste is always sort of something that's looming on our minds as urban consumers and producers. And at the same time, I think, yeah, we're just trying to create alternative systems so that, yeah, that food waste is not happening on the same scale that it is. I mean, I think some is always inevitable. I think when you're creating abundance, there is going to be some natural loss, but certainly not on the scale that of our global food system that we've created.
Well, I'd like David and Jonathan to tell us a little bit more about East New York Farms in Brooklyn, what it is, and you know, how you combine the gardening, the farmer's market, the youth internship program, how it's grown. Give us a bit of the history and then what it is now, if you both could.
East New York Farms started in 1998. That's the first time we had our farmer's market. Just to tell you a little bit of the history, during that time, East New York wasn't a place for gardening. It was just empty lots where there was basically nothing. And so people of the community came together, opened up the farm, worked at the farm right here, and they opened up the farmer's market. It started with one community member just selling at the corner of the street, and that's when the United Community Centers came in. They helped everyone else in the community come together as gardeners and start the farmer's market. So the youth internship, how it works is we have about 33 interns who work with us from March to November, and usually this year we just finished interviewing about 120 new interns for our internship. We only have 20 spots for them, and we get 14 returning interns from previous years and 20 new interns, I guess. And what they do is they start working at our garden right on New Lots. It's right on New Lots and Skank. And what they do is they basically help prep the garden for planting, and then they plant. And throughout the year, they take care of the plants. And starting in June, they start selling at our farmers market. They have their own stand, and they manage the cash registers, they handle the customers, and, yeah, they sell throughout the entire year till November when the internship comes to end. Also, it's not just only about working in the farm. They go to different conferences. We teach them different workshops about food justice, about composting. We even have like some workshops during the summer for older youth who are going to college, just like, you know, the college process and everything. I was actually an intern with the program in 2008. I joined in 2008, and I continued for a few years, and then I was referred to an externship program from East New York Farms. I did a few years over there, and then I remember when I was a senior in high school, one of the staff member wrote me a recommendation letter that helped me get a scholarship, and I'm so grateful for that.
All right, very good. So that's sort of a snapshot of it. And David, I've seen you discuss in videos that the legacy that's being created in those spaces now is a vibrant green space, but it's replacing the legacy of white flight and abandonment. Is that right?
Yeah. So East New York, starting in the 60s, the white residents from East New York were moving out into the suburbs of Long Island, New Jersey, Connecticut, there was redlining, blockbusting, arson, abandonment that was happening throughout the community, and so it resulted in a lot of vacant lots, a lot of abandoned buildings, and a big loss for the commercial sector and manufacturing sector here in East New York.
And I'm sorry, but can you just, for the people who may be hearing this saying, well, look, there's abandoned lots, there's that kind of situation. Rochester's seen plenty of it. I'm sure a lot of communities have. But how much availability is there to take those lots and turn toward urban agriculture without working with government regulation, getting green lighted? I mean, how much red tape is there?
Well, so a lot of the community gardens in East New York sprouted up at a time when New York City was in the middle of a budget crisis. And so as these lots were being abandoned because they're being foreclosed on because the owners weren't paying taxes on them any longer, it created a crisis where the city had a diminishing tax base and it had all of these properties that they couldn't maintain. So residents were actually being proactive and taking over these lots and improving them and doing a service for the city. And they've been doing that for decades. And so I think we were lucky as a community to really have a lot of resilience and a lot of initiative to do that at a time when it was when the city was not in a position to maintain those lots. I think it's a little bit more difficult now, but it's still happening in our community, and I think if it can happen in some place like New York City where there's so much competition for real estate, then I think it should be able to be translatable to other cities.
Well, let's see what our guests in the studio think. We're hearing from David Vahil and Yanatul Rahman from East New York Farms in Brooklyn as we discuss the benefits of urban agriculture. It's the subject of the Reshaping Rochester Series next event that is next Tuesday night, and you can still get tickets. We'll make sure you're directed to the website if you want to check that out. I'm wondering what Nathaniel Mish thinks about that. He's Community Programs Coordinator for Foodlink and Manager of the Lexington Avenue Urban Farm. You know, there's a number of lots that might be ripe for this kind of thing, but is there the opportunity to do that? I mean, how do you feel about that, Nathaniel?
Sure. So there are over 2,100 vacant city-owned lots in the city of Rochester. If you are a community member who wants to start a community garden, it's actually a pretty simple process. There's a free permit available online that you submit to the real estate department of the city of Rochester to get that permission. However, it's a temporary permit, so it's only good from March to December of any given calendar year, and you have to renew it every single year. And in that January to February gap, the garden has no legal claim or real protection on the land. So some cities have leasing models. Other cities make purchasing very easy. It's really great here that in Rochester it's free and it's very simple to get that permit. But again, it's built to treat urban agriculture community gardens as a temporary use on the land. The idea being that this is something that can be done on the land until quote unquote real development occurs there, which I think is unfortunate. And I think is a perception that we'd like to flip. Foodlink and the broader urban agriculture community, the urban agriculture working group that I work with. The Lexington Avenue Farm, which I manage, is actually the only, to my knowledge, the only urban agriculture site in Rochester where we have an actual lease with the city. So we're working on a multi-year lease.
How come you got the lease when that's not really happening in other places?
Because we, a few years ago, built a hoop house on that site, and in the negotiations with the city and with zoning to get the permission to put up that hoop house, Foodlink stressed that we weren't going to make that investment in the land without some longer-term protections, that we weren't just going to get booted out if, you know, a dollar store came along.
All right, but just to clarify what Nathaniel's saying here, it sounds like what you're saying is the city of Rochester, in some sense, is really helpful with this because you can get the permits, mm-hmm. it's free, you can access the land, but it's viewed as temporary, and it's not necessarily viewed as a serious long-term thing.
Correct.
And are there other communities, models out there that you would like to see Rochester follow that do view it more seriously?
So I've been learning more about Cleveland. I want to stress, too, that I do feel that the city of Rochester does take community gardening seriously in urban agriculture, and they've been a really great partner in a lot of different ways. We're trying to work with them and work with our gardeners in general to just kind of get to the next level. So in Cleveland, it's actually... They had a ton of vacant city-owned lots. It's kind of the classic Rust Belt trajectory. And they decided that they were really going to focus on letting residents decide what was going to happen with those. So in Cleveland, it's very simple to get a lease on city-owned land that protects it for multiple years. There are some drawbacks with that system. It's actually quite difficult there to purchase the land. And it can also be a little difficult for that first sort of entry-level garden. But I think that, you know, a model in which an established garden can, you know, there are gardens in Rochester that have been around for more than a decade now. They should be able to petition somehow for some longer-term recognition of their constructive use of this land.
Okay, and... if you haven't seen, for example, Lexington Avenue Urban Farm, can you paint us a little picture, Nathaniel?
Sure. So most of your listeners probably know Rochester used to have a subway system. And there was a subway station at the corner of Lexington and Curlew in northwest Rochester, and that was at the head of a large subway bed. So in the 70s, that subway bed was filled in, and it's now about 7.5 acres of vacant city-owned green space. To my knowledge, it's the largest single parcel of that land in Rochester. And the Lexington Avenue Urban Farm is on a couple other city-owned lots right at the head of that. So we lease 1.3 acres from the city, and the farm is divided into a couple components. We have a community garden that serves about 60 primarily refugee families, and then we have a small commercial growing operation that includes the hoop house that I mentioned, which is a plastic-covered greenhouse. We have beehives, we have fruit trees, and then we've got space for field crops as well.
All right. I'm going to grab our first phone call in just a second here. I'll want to remind our listeners that this event coming up next Tuesday, focusing on the benefits of urban agriculture, you'll have the chance to hear from East New York Farms. You'll have the chance to hear about the Rochester perspective and what could be, you know, either coming to our community, or I think when you listen to Nathaniel Mish, you hear what might be expanded or made permanent in our community. That's next Tuesday night. It starts, Maria, when?
It is at 7 o'clock Tuesday evening, and all of our evening lectures are held at the Gleason Works Auditorium at 1000 University Avenue.
$15 a person. You can get tickets now at cdcrochester.org. You have comments or questions on urban agriculture, you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. I want to know what Lisa Zeller is doing as well. But before, Lisa, we jump in with you, we got a question from a listener I think all of our guests may have a chance to answer, and it's an astute one. This is Ryan in East Rochester. Go ahead, Ryan.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
At the risk of sounding like a conspiracy nut, I recently saw an article where U.S. forest biologists in California were testing water and soil samples, and they were coming up with extremely highly elevated levels of unbonded aluminum, which they cannot explain where it's come from. Now, I'm on the fence as to whether or not it's coming from aircraft spraying, geoengineering, or whatever. But my question to these folks is, have any of them noticed or discovered extremely high levels of any foreign particles, particulates, or nanoparticles that may in fact be harmful to us, either through rainwater or being present in the soils? Thank you very much.
Ryan, thank you. Okay, so maybe the broader question is this. You're talking abandoned lots. Are we worried about soil samples? How do we know it's a good place to put a farm down? I'm going to start in studio here in Rochester, and then we'll go to Brooklyn, and I'll start with Nathaniel. What would you say to that?
Sure. So like any Rust Belt city, Rochester has a really old housing stock. The vast majority of the houses here were built in the 70s or prior, so lead is an issue. A lot of residential lots have some measure of lead in the soil. So if you have a community garden permit to grow on city-owned land, the city requires you to bring in your own soil. Usually build raised beds, put the soil in that, make sure there's a barrier between the plant roots and the native soil. So lead is sort of the biggest concern. But what research shows is that most plants that put out fruiting vegetables don't actually take up lead into the fruit. So like a tomato plant, if there's lead in the soil, it will put lead into its stems and leaves, but not into the tomato itself. So really the biggest risk is from lead dust simply settling on the fruits and vegetables, which is why washing your produce, always washing your produce, but especially when you're bringing it out of an urban setting is really important.
Okay. Yeah. And to our guests from Brooklyn, how would you answer that question?
Yeah, we would echo what Nathaniel mentioned. And, you know, we work closely with Brooklyn College and to do soil testing on a regular basis. And I think, yeah, there are a lot of well-known and commonly practiced measures that you can take to minimize exposure, but we also test our soil regularly to make sure that there's not any sort of lead or other heavy metals. I think also, yeah, there is sort of this perception that somehow food coming from urban areas is somehow contaminated or the air is worse or the soil is worse, and I think having spent plenty of time in the Central Valley in California, where the vast majority of the nation's fruits and vegetables come from, where the air quality is poor, where you don't really have any knowledge of what the soil practices are, what the water is like, I think just being, having agriculture within your own community and you can have the discussions with the growers and see what they're doing and ask them about that is one significant advantage to urban agriculture that we really like to highlight.
Definitely.
Dorothy writes to the program and says, the city offers a map of available vacant properties to find a lot near you to place a garden. It is linked to the garden permit page. So, you know, should be easy to check out there. Lisa Zeller's an 8th grade science teacher and a garden club advisor at World of Inquiry School and involved in the greenhouse and garden programs, which partners with, for example, Hart's Local Grocers to sell the food. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
How much food are we talking about?
Very limited right now. We've piloted a program. We're now in our second year with Hart's. We're selling herbs that we're growing in the greenhouse and the garden to them at their local market days.
Okay. And, you know, how do you view this issue broadening growing? In Rochester.
So to speak about the vacant lots and the map that is available, we actually use that. So mm-hmm. this time last year, we were granted an opportunity to receive some donor money from Rochester Education Foundation to start some gardening at our school. The issue is that our school is located downtown, and we have zero green space on our actual city, our school property. So we used that vacant lot map to find an area locally in the neighborhood, which is the Market View Heights neighborhood. So we partnered with that neighborhood to determine which space made most sense and was close enough to our school so our students could walk there. And we acquired the land using the garden permit. I think an important thing for me to share from our experiences is that when you get the land, it's just the land. There's no water included in that. So we use a rain barrel that we actually... very nicely have our neighbor next door provides us with water from his house to fill the rain barrel. So the city, we were told, that would not give us direct water to the land until at least 3 years of proving to them that we can continue our gardening there.
Okay, sounds like you've been creative, though.
Yes, you have to be.
Yeah, and it's going okay?
Mm-hmm. Yes, our students, so our program is 100% student-led. So when we got the money and we started meeting with Market View Heights, our students were involved in every single phase. They designed the space themselves, so they went to the lot and measured it out, determined how many beds they wanted to build. They were told how much money they had, and they made it happen. So we used as many local resources as we could, and they designed, they built, and they planted, and we've had one successful growing season, and right now we're getting ready for our next. We're very excited.
Lisa, I think you're pretty well suited to answer this, probably Nathaniel as well. Here's an email from a listener named Amber. She says, I noticed the voices from Rochester on your program sound pretty homogenous today, white, 20 to 30 something, highly educated. Is urban ag in Rochester actually that homogenous? And if so, how is the urban ag community working to improve racial, economic, and linguistic diversity? Are there young people included in working as leaders? That's from Amber.
Yeah, so I can start. World of Inquiry is... 85 or higher percent African-American population. So more than half of my students involved in the garden club are not white. So it's definitely not a homogenous group of people working on this. At our school, again, working with Market View Heights neighborhood, that's also a very diverse group of people who have partnered with us. So Fritos Garden is right down the street. They are one of our partners. So I do not believe that it's a homogenous group of people that are working on this. It's very diverse. And again, to stress our program at World of Inquiry, it is 100% student-led. So our youth decide what's going to be planted, how it's going to be planted, and how they're going to use the space. They also decide where the food goes. So last year, they decided that they wanted it to go to the local community and to our school community. So parents were invited from the school at any time throughout the summer to come and pick the produce that was there, as well as anyone in the neighborhood, and they did.
Nathaniel, what do you think?
Sure. So first, I would say I'd love to pitch the idea of having a broader urban agriculture discussion here sometime so that we can bring in more of the community leaders as well. The urban agriculture community here in Rochester is diverse, and it's throughout Rochester. One of the things I had the privilege of doing through my work at Foodlink is working with the Urban Agriculture Working Group, which is a collaborative of community garden leaders, urban ag allies from a variety of sectors, as well as a bunch of community garden managers. And we're really working to build that network so that we can help develop community leaders, provide development opportunities to existing community leaders, and really make sure that we are presenting as a diverse community and as a community that represents all the different types of people who are working here. I mean, the best example I can speak to is in my own personal experience, where when I joined a community garden 6 years ago, I have found no single better place to meet people, to build relationships with people who don't look like me, who aren't from my social or economic background, who aren't my age, who weren't born in the same place. So I think that urban agriculture and community gardens have a ton of potential to be a really great mixer for that.
And, there are a number of gardens, leaders we could mention, people like Tanya Stevens, the Front Street Garden, among others. So, and you're right, Nathaniel. Maybe we'll come back on a different day and talk about the broader scope of what's going on there in Rochester. And Amber, I think it's a fair question and a good one, and I appreciate it. We're late for our only break, and we'll come back. We'll get more of your questions in. If you want to talk urban agriculture, 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. Nathaniel Misch is Community Programs Coordinator for Foodlink and manager of the Lexington Avenue Urban Farm. Lisa Zeller, 8th grade science teacher and the Garden Club Advisor at World of Inquiry School. Maria Fergiuelli is here, the Interim Executive Director of the Community Design Center of Rochester, which is putting on this event next Tuesday night at 7 p.m. And that is going to be bringing in the folks from East New York Farms. David Vahil on the line with us, along with Jonatul Rahman, and they are calling us from Brooklyn, where they've had great success with these kinds of programs. So let's get that only break of the hour and come back to more of your questions next on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, Byron Burgeon High School is getting ready to debut a brand new musical. Not Fiddler on the Roof, not a classic musical. Lawrence Tallman is their director of vocal music and drama, and he wrote Ten Again. It's set in 1976 America. It is in many ways about race and our differences and how to bridge them. And the performance uses music and humor to do that. We'll explore it next hour. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Kim on Twitter wants to know if there is, hold on, I'm sorry, Kim, phone just blacked out on me. Just wants to know, she says, great topic on community gardens. Is there funding to help cover the cost to start a garden? Let me start in studio, and then we're going to turn to Brooklyn to find out how they really got going in the last decade, if they had, you know, those kinds of supports. But here in Rochester, Nathaniel, is there funding to start a garden here?
So there are pockets of funding. A couple small grants circulating around and fundraising opportunities. The Rochester Area Community Foundation has their Neighbor Good program. It focuses on east side or west side of the city, alternating years. I know several community gardens have gotten funding through that. There are crowdfunding opportunities online, an organization called Seed Money. But really, it is a challenge to find funding. Most community gardens are self-funded, or they have to rely on recycled or repurposed materials. One of the things we were able to do through the Urban Agriculture Working Group last year is get a grant from the Community Foundation that we were then able to split a portion of that money into 10 micro-grants that we partnered with the City of Rochester to basically allow community gardens to purchase materials at the city's negotiated, like, wholesale prices to use for their gardens, to help them stretch a limited pool of funding to make an impact on their gardens. So we received something like 25 applications and selected 10 gardens to receive that funding, and it's had a big impact on what they're doing. So through the working group, we're trying to make opportunities like that more visible, more accessible, and by always presenting as a collaborative effort, collaboration is really attractive to funders. So whenever you can say, okay, my garden's going to partner with this school or with this neighborhood group, that really has a big impact on your desirability as a funding opportunity.
All right, let me turn to Brooklyn and to Jonatul and David to talk about East New York Farms. you know, here you are after, well, I actually don't even know the exact year that you launched it, but when, if listeners, if you missed it earlier this hour, when you go from the kinds of lots that they were talking about, which is the result of white flight, redlining, abandonment of buildings, arson, and you create these vibrant green spaces, what's the short answer for how you did that, David and Jonathan?
Yeah, well, the early years were really ad hoc community initiatives. As during the early 90s, as they were starting to rebuild some housing in East New York, a lot of the community gardens were developed because people were buying their first homes in East New York, and they wanted to make sure that the lot on their block was clean. And so they were typically neighbor-led efforts, and they would get whatever free materials they could, wood chips, pallets, et cetera, to repurpose and get the lots clean. Over time, though, the City Parks Department, who are the owners of the lots, were able to invest in some infrastructure like fences and bring in some lumber and soil. And so I think having a long partnership with the city certainly helps. And overall, cost-wise, it's not a major expense to provide small amounts of lumber or seeds or plants to these gardens. You know, when you consider New York City has over 500 community gardens and that these are spaces that would otherwise have to be cleaned or maintained by our Department of Sanitation. Community gardens have so much benefit relative to the investment that it takes. In addition to that, we also do a mini grant program similar to what Nathaniel mentioned. And there are other sort of grassroots funding groups that are now offering these kind of grants to community groups. So I think now more than ever, it's a really much easier time to start up a garden. But I do think the bigger question of things like liability insurance and fences and things that really do take some capital input, like, I think that's where city government really needs to play a role.
Erica writes to the program and wants to know, what are the best crops to grow on a small lot? Lisa Zeller, I'll start with you. Small lot.
Sure. So our lot is not very large. We only have 8 raised beds, and you can grow a lot of things here in Rochester. So I think it depends on what you're looking for. We did an entire bed just of herbs. We did an entire bed of collard greens. We did a mixture of what you could make salsa from, so tomatoes, cucumbers, sofritos, peppers. So it's really, I think, what you want to grow for yourself and for your community.
Nathaniel, are we too limited in our imagination on what we can grow here?
Ooh, I've seen and heard a lot of different kinds of things being grown around here. There's an increased interest in growing your own edible mushrooms, in doing fruit cultivation. But really, Rochester, when we're not having a spring that's 2 months early, has a really fantastic growing season. And so almost any vegetable you can dream of, you can grow here. I'm constantly surprised and amazed by the variety of plants that our refugee families are growing in at the Lexington farm.
For example?
Well, first of all, lots of things that we would dismiss as weeds, plants like pigsweed or lamb's quarters, which are actually highly nutritious and really well adapted here, edible varieties of hibiscus, herbs and medicinal plants that I still haven't been able to figure out the English name for. It's really kind of remarkable to see that all bloom.
David and Jonathan, what would you say to Erica's email? Small lot, she's got a small lot, best crops for a small lot.
I mean, I agree that we leave it to your imagination and grow whatever you want to grow. So for our farm, it's pretty small. We have a bunch of greens, Swiss chard, perpetual spinach, lettuce, we have salad mix, we did callaloo. I think this year we are planning on planting jute. We have bunch of herbs, rosemary, basil, cilantro. I mean, yeah, and then we also have some Caribbean crops like bitter melon. Some people call it carilla. We have cucumbers. We have bunch of tomatoes and lots of hot peppers, different types of hot peppers.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls. Michael in Geneva, next up on the phones. Go ahead, Michael.
Yes, hello. I used to be the county extension educator for Cleveland and the surrounding suburbs, and specifically horticulture and ag. And I just think that Rochester's going in the right direction, and do everything you can to get that full year leaf, because that extends your types of crops, and it can extend the growing season. You can start in March if you have row covers or small low tunnels, or you need to plant your garlic in the fall. And if you lose the space, then you can't have your garlic next summer, or it's not as big. So it looks like Rochester's going in the right direction, and I really hope the best for you.
Well, thank you, Michael. I appreciate the phone call. I know Nathaniel Mish agrees entirely on getting that full year lease. But do you understand the argument against it, Nathaniel? I mean, what do they tell you when the conversation comes up, hey, this is great. We appreciate the fact that, you know, you've got this map, that people can find the lots, that it's free to get a permit, but it's not really viewed as a long-term thing. Do they tell you why?
When a reason is given, it's usually because community gardens don't generate property taxes, right? So Rochester does have a shrinking tax base, and I think it can be difficult for city officials or for decision makers in other capacities who aren't already involved in urban agriculture to understand the benefits that go beyond, okay, well, this is a building that we can tax or a business that we can tax. So wanting to hold on to it for taxable development and to have that flexibility. But frankly, a lot of community gardens are on what the city considers unbuildable lots. Lots that are too narrow to build a home by modern standards.
Which also provide nothing in the way of taxes, by the way.
Right.
And can I just offer a really sort of dangerously, ignorantly, maybe even dumb question? But because I'm hearing you describe this, the concern that, well, maybe it's not going to generate taxes, et cetera. What if there were an agreement that said, okay, you're not going to generate taxes. The lot's yours. We'll do a year-to-year lease. We'll do a year-round lease. And we'll view it with some permanence, but we want a fifth of what you produce for our schools, that kind of a thing.
That would be amazing. Or, you know, we talk so much in development about payments in lieu of taxes, right? Like, what if we had a community development in lieu of taxes?
Food in lieu of taxes.
Right, yeah. I think that I would be really interested in exploring something like that.
All right, so maybe there are some creative solutions out there. David, do you think there's some sense in that idea, or is that sort of a pipe dream?
No, I definitely agree, and I think we've also really tried to work to expand the view of, you know, what all these community gardens do provide. So there's a social component, there's a nutrition component, there's an environmental component, especially here in New York City with stormwater collection. And so I think there are a lot of different benefits that I think, especially here in New York, we've been really trying to illustrate all of the different services that gardens provide. And I think if you can make that, yeah, use science and use good metrics to make that case to city officials, I think you can probably have a lot of traction.
All right, let's get a couple more listener questions in here, and I'm going to go to, I think, Ms. Zeller's students might be listening now. In fact, yes, Ms. Zeller's class, which is always the best way to spend your afternoons, teachers and classes out there, is listening to Connections. I think that's a very smart way to educate
Absolutely.
Students. And they're listening now, and they want to know, what is the best way to incorporate play into urban gardens, Ms. Zeller?
It's a wonderful question, my lovely students. So I think they want a little shout out right now.
That's okay.
You yep. Currently, we're an expeditionary learning school, which means we engage students in in-depth studies of different things in society. And right now, our students are learning all about activism. So in science class, we're looking at environmental activism, and they are currently, right now, while they're listening to Connections, they are researching current models of nature play spaces throughout the world, and they are going to be creating their own designs for vacant lots here in Rochester, and they will be presenting those hopefully to City Council within the next month or so to see whether or not they'll partner with us.
Very cool. thank you, students, for listening, and we appreciate the question. I've got about 10 more minutes left if you want to call 844-295-TALK. We're talking urban agriculture, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Maria Frigueli is the Interim Executive Director of the Community Design Center of Rochester, and they put on this annual series this time of year, Reshaping Rochester. And so this is one of the events. It's coming up next Tuesday. How many more events do you have, by the way, Maria? I mean, we're kind of halfway through the season, or we're getting
Yes, we're going to have, after David's presentation on Tuesday, we have a presentation in April, that is Rebecca Morley coming to speak about health impacts. And then we have our luncheon speaker, which would be our capstone event at the end of the season in May.
All right, so cdcrochester.org if you want tickets to come hear about the success in Brooklyn of East New York Farms. That's this coming Tuesday night, 7 o'clock at Gleason Works Auditorium. $15 for tickets at cdcrochester.org. John, via email, says, is PCB exposure a concern when container gardening using drywall buckets? Container gardening is a good way to have urban gardens when you don't have land. Hydroponic addition can boost production as well. Nathaniel, I'll start with you. What would you
say? Containers are great. You do want to make sure you understand the materials that you're working with. So I couldn't speak specifically to drywall buckets. Plastics of any kind, there's always going to be some exchange between them and the soil, and a lot of that is dependent on heat and moisture. So I'm a big fan of just plain old untreated pine for making boxes, or there's a really neat class of products out there called root pouches. These are really durable bags made out of recycled bottles. You can buy some that are just meant to last for a season or some that will last forever. And they provide a nice sort of breathability to them. So there's really endless possibilities. At the Lexington Avenue Urban Farm that I manage for Foodlink, we've got a range of bed building styles, everything from recycled Cambro insulated food storage coolers to traditional wood to old pond liner, really whatever we could get our hands on at the time. So use your imagination, but do some research into the materials, too.
Okay. David and Jonathan, agree with that?
Yep. Yeah, that's sound advice.
Very good. I see the phone ringing. We'll get back to your phone calls in just a second. It's 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. And our guests are joining us from Brooklyn, but I guess David, I want to know if you think there is a model even outside of yours, you know, what are the places that are really doing urban agriculture well?
Yeah, I think, that's a great question. I think we are really interested in community-led projects. So one of the organizations that we really admire is called the Greening of Detroit, and they, similar to us, are focused on gardens and community members sort of as the drivers of urban agriculture. I think sort of oftentimes the impression, especially in New York, is that urban agriculture is a high-tech thing, you know, that happens on rooftops and in hydroponic greenhouses. But in fact, most of the people growing food in New York City are living in lower middle-income communities. They're mostly people of color. They're oftentimes immigrants, and they're often growing in their yards or community gardens. And so I think organizations like the Greening of Detroit, they recognize that there is just that depth of knowledge and experience amongst the community. And so they work and organize gardeners to improve food growth and food production in the city while still making sure that the benefits of that, the income and the jobs, stay within the communities that are most affected.
Maria Frigueli from the Community Design Center had a smile for me when you mentioned Detroit, because there, I think your last speaker was from Detroit. A lot going on in Detroit, isn't there, Maria?
Yes, there is, and it was a really wonderful coincidence the way this presentation coming up on Tuesday, how that kind of partners and goes with the information that was provided by Maurice Cox at our last presentation talking about how they're handling their vacant spaces.
Very good. Well, Trish in Rochester wants to weigh in on that question on sort of sharing food, so go ahead, Trish.
Oh, yes, good afternoon. I've only heard the last 10 minutes of your show. And I've heard two things that made me smile. One was Nathaniel talking about fencing for community gardens. I've been involved with a community garden at Portland and Roycroft for about 5 years, and if we had fences, then we would have enough produce to give to schools, because most of our produce, our fruits, vegetables, and flowers disappear before we have them. But that's okay, because it is a community garden, and we are across the street from a food bank, so we have a plethora of tomatoes all the time. We have lots of herbs, and so we take all of that harvest in July and August, and across the street it goes. So we're truly a community garden, and I just had to smile when you say if we you, and we use our garden all year long, even though we do have only officially a lease for the summer months with the city.
Okay, I don't know if you're allowed to say that.
Well, our garlic's in there now, and it goes in every fall,
yeah,
and we harvest
there
it every July. So
hey, Trish, but before you go, can I just ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
You're indicating that, you know, you said the food sort of disappears. People will help themselves to it. Is that what you're saying? Okay.
Yeah.
And okay. Yeah. I'm just trying to make sure I understand. I mean, are you cautioning that if people end up growing on lots that will happen, or is that part of the process? I mean, what do you think?
Well, because I missed most of your show, I thought maybe it had already been addressed. But that is the reality of a community garden that is not fenced. Your produce, your harvest walks. But if it's for the community, then that's really what you're there for, right?
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you, Trish, for the phone call. Lisa and Nathaniel first, and then we'll turn to our guest from Brooklyn. I mean, Lisa, do you agree with that? Does it happen?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that was a big part of conversations that we had with our students when we were designing our garden space and what we were going to plant, was to be mindful that that was going to happen. And they were excited. They wanted to be a part of feeding the community. I think we also need to be concerned about animals as well.
Oh,
we
yes.
know our squirrels in Rochester are pretty vicious.
Okay. Nathaniel?
Yeah. I mean, it's the gardens that I work with for FoodLink that are at our food pantries and soup kitchens, actually, they also deal with theft. And it's kind of the heartbreaking reality of growing food in high needs neighborhoods. On city-owned land, it gets a little more complicated because you're not technically allowed to install a fence on city-owned land. And I've been working with a couple gardens that have been trying to figure out some workarounds to that by doing, you know, plantings that create, you know, more of a psychological barrier, or by stringing 2x4s across the bollards that mark off a vacant lot. So that's a challenge. And, you know, I'm torn because on the one hand, you know, I know what it feels like to see your produce walk away. But I also don't want community gardens to feel like fortresses, right? Most people are growing food, even if it's for their own family, in community, mm-hmm. right? That's the important part of it, is to do it with people.
David and Jonathan, what do you think?
So just to, I guess, say a little bit about me, I am also a community gardener, and I totally agree with, like, you know, that heartbreaking feeling when you see that something was there yesterday and it's not there today. But just when I think about it, like, a little bit more, like, you know, it's vegetables. Mm-hmm. At least they're eating healthy. Mm-hmm. At least they're, like, you know, they have something that they want to eat, or something that they, like, you know, it's, again, just to go back, community, someone from the community is taking it from a community garden, and I think that's okay. Like, I'm sad a little bit that it's someone's taking my produce, but at the end of the day, it makes sense. They want to eat healthy, or
sure.
It's just, like, you know, I'm providing something to the community.
David, before we let you go here, what do you want our listeners to know about what you're going to be bringing in terms of a subject next Tuesday night?
Yeah, we want to really tell the story of East New York, and I think in terms of some of its history and some of the context is very similar to Rochester, and I think there's a lot of resilience and just a really important story to tell about sort of the community-led efforts to use urban agriculture as a way to grow more food, create jobs, and build community. And I think that's really what we want to share, is that I think, you know, East New York is still fighting those battles, and just in the same way that I think Rochester is, but I think really the solutions are within, right there within the community, and we really just want to make sure that story is known.
And I'm going to sneak in one more question. This is from Dorothy. She says, wouldn't it be great if the Interloop Reclamation Project provided on-site garden space to World of Inquiry students?
Yes, thank you, Dorothy. thank you.
That was such a softball to end for you. You'd love to see that, wouldn't you?
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think that our city school district needs to step up as well in our green initiatives and support schools in doing this. Our students are the future, and so we need to incorporate some sustainability education in our school district.
Lisa Zeller teaches at the World of Inquiry School, among other projects. It's great having you. Thank you for being here, Lisa.
Thank you.
And thanks to your students for hanging in and listening as well.
Yes.
Nathaniel Mish, Community Programs Coordinator for FoodLink, thanks for sharing your expertise as well.
My pleasure.
Maria Fergiuelli, we'll see you next Tuesday night at Gleason Works Auditorium, cdcrochester.org for tickets. Thanks for being here, Maria.
Thank you.
And on the line with us, I want to thank David Vahil and Yanatul Rahman from East New York Farms in Brooklyn. Congratulations, David and Jonathan, on all of the success there, and thanks for taking the time.
Thanks. We're looking forward to coming to Rochester soon.
You got it.
Thank you for having us.
All right, short break. More Connections is next.